Mr. DeMille. I'm ready for my close-up.
I'll show up sometime. See me.
Aiden Bond! Top of the world!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night, sir.
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hi, Wendy here. Before we start off our episode today, I want to remind everybody to check us out on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. Also, please leave a rating or comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can find us on social media by simply searching Silver Screen Time Machine, and please make sure you follow our podcast, Silver Screen Time Machine, anywhere you get your podcast. Thank you and enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome again to Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy's Classic Film Review. Today we have a guest, a returning guest, Debbie. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Wendy.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming back. I don't know if you want to do a quick refresher on anything about yourself.
You and I started the Pittsburgh Classic Movie Club together in 2019. Yep. Gosh, it feels so long ago. So much has happened since. But I'm just a really great fan of classic films,
same as you.
Not as knowledgeable, of course, but I still love to talk about them, and I'm very excited to be here today.
Yeah, awesome. Last time you were here, we did a Christmas film. We did We're No Angels.
Yes.
We did that was a very obscure film, and today we are also doing a very obscure film.
Yes, we are.
So we are getting in our time machine, and we are going back to
1959.
And we are going to talk about
The Journey.
The Journey. How many of you folks know about this film?
Probably not many.
This is a rare one.
Which is sad. It's so sad. Everybody watch this movie.
Yes. We insist you watch this movie.
Yes.
So let's start out a little bit about this film. Loosely based on a short story by Guy de Maupassant.
Good for you. I didn't even want to try to pronounce that.
Guy de Maupassant. Even though this is not a French movie, somehow we get stuck with French names. Anyhow, the name of this short story was Boulet de Suif, which literally means ball of fat.
or dumpling.
And I guess it's about this lady. They've taken quite a lot of liberties, apparently, because it was about a prostitute, what's Lady Ashmore's character in the book, a prostitute named Dumpling.
Right.
Lovely and flattering. But in the original story, Major Suroff,
I would say
that. Major Suroff, he's the Prussian officer. This is set during the Franco-Prussian War. They say this has also been used as the basis for other films and TV episodes as well, but didn't really specify what ones.
I read that too. It makes me want to go search now, hunt down, see what else borrowed from this.
Don't leave us hanging. What are they? So anyhow, but a similarity in this is the travelers trying to pressure Dumpling to sacrifice herself to the officer for their freedom. A little bit about our friend Guy. Let's just say his first name and make it easier. Guy was considered the originator of the modern short story. He was the protege of Gustave Flaubert, who did Madame Bovary. He wrote 300 short stories in a not a very long career. He wrote in what was considered a naturalistic way, and he based many of his stories on the Franco-Prussian War, which he fought in for France. Unfortunately, it was believed that he had contracted syphilis at birth and would eventually show signs of mental instability, including attempting suicide, and was taken off to a mental hospital and died at the age of 42.
Wow, that's quite a life. But I did not know that
part. In between, he wrote 300 short stories somehow.
That is incredible.
Our screenplay is by George Tabori. We're just taking a wild guess at that one. He was born in Hungary and would eventually go to Berlin, where he was forced to flee when the Nazis came to power. He was Jewish. In fact, his family was Jewish and his father was killed at Auschwitz.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. He would immigrate to Britain and then to the U.S. He was a novelist and a playwright and would also work on screenplays when he came to the U.S., including the film I Confess, which is a Montgomery Clift film, my man.
Yep.
He lived to be 93 years old. It's believed that the screenplay started out very idealized, but both Tabori and director Litvak were forced to make concessions, and there was a lot of rewriting involved. As a matter of fact, they said it was very messy in production because of all the rewriting on the screenplay. And in fact, Deborah Carr's husband, Peter Vertel,
I think that's how you pronounce it.
Assisted in the writing process, but he was completely uncredited. So speaking of Litvak, Anatole Litvak, this is our director. He was born in modern day Ukraine, which was then part of the Russian Empire. He would begin training as an actor in Russia as young as 13. He would go on to direct in Russia, but then would move to Germany for better freedom in his films. However, also being Jewish, he was forced to leave Germany when Hitler came to power and he went to France. His film Mayerling, starring Charles Boyer, was his breakout film in France, and it also helped him move on to Hollywood. He would marry Miriam Hopkins and would try in the early days of World War II to convince the U.S. public that Germany needed to be dealt with through his film Confessions of a Nazi Spy. At that point, it was a common perception by Americans that it was a European war and they didn't want to get involved. But when the U.S. did finally join the war, Litvak enlisted and he produced a documentary series with Frank Capra called Why We Fight. Litvak was said to have a talent for bringing out great performances in his actors, and several were nominated for Academy Awards in his films, including Ingrid Bergman in Anastasia, Barbara Stanwyck in Sorry Wrong Number, Olivia de Havilland in The Snake Pit. He was nominated for Oscars for Decision Before Dawn and The Snake Pit. It was said that based on The Snake Pit, changes were made to the American mental health system. I guess it was a very meaningful film. I've not seen it.
I haven't either.
But I might consider trying to see it now.
Right, yeah.
Because it sounds interesting.
That does sound good.
They said Olivia de Havilland played a mentally ill person in this, and they actually went to mental institutions, Litvak and Olivia de Havilland, to observe mental health patients.
Sold. I'm checking this out.
Yeah. According to film historian Ronald Bowers, Litvak became skilled in using location shooting, which we have here, and realistic documentary effects as early as 1930s. He also became known in the industry for emphasizing sound effects over dialogue in sound films. I think we hear this too in this film. He preferred to keep the camera running with tracking shots and pans. I see that in this film.
Yep.
And given his preference for achieving motion in camera work, he often used crane shots and sat with the cameraman to be sure he was getting what he wanted. Which brings us to the cameraman, cinematographer Jack Hilliard. I keep getting him. We just had him in The Yellow Rose Royce. He was a cinematographer. He won an Oscar for David Lean's Bridge on the River Kwai. Yep. He did a couple other films with David Lean. We talked about him a bit in The Yellow Rose Royce, so I don't want to talk about him too much here. But his other films included Anastasia, The Sundowners, which is a great film with Deborah Carr.
Another Deborah Carr.
And Casino Royale. This film, I thought this was interesting. So did you notice it says this film was shot in Metrocolor?
Yes. They make that very prevalent yes. in the opening credits. Yes.
Do you know what Metrocolor means?
Probably not like a
yes.
definitive.
So it is actually a trade name used by MGM for films processed in their own laboratory. Virtually all of these films were shot on Kodak's Eastman Color film in 1952. Eastman Kodak introduced a high-color print film allowing studios to produce prints through standard photographic processes as opposed to having to send them to Technicolor for expensive dye process. But the fact is that instead of sending the prints and the camera film to Technicolor, they had their own film process, Metrocolor.
Very interesting.
So that's what this is. Okay, the score music by Georges Auric.
Sure.
Another French guy, I guess. This fellow, interesting. He was a child prodigy in composing music. He was composing as young as 14, and he was also a child prodigy as a pianist. He was one of what they call Les Six, which is the six, a bunch of composers that their music is often seen as a neoclassic reaction against both the musical style of Richard Wagner and the impressionist music of Claude Debussy,
I would say,
and Maurice Ravel. So this music was considered rather avant-garde at the time of the 1910s and 1920s. So from my understanding of that, it seems like they're trying to go against the traditional classic and make something more avant-garde in their compositions. That was my understanding of that. But he began to compose music for film in the 1930s, and he was attempting to appeal to a wider audiences. Some films are Roman Holiday, Heaven Knows Mr. Allison, which is another Deborah Carr
Deborah
movie,
Carr.
And Rafifi, which I just recently saw. I'm not a huge fan of the music in this film.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I like it. Well,
it's so...
They use the Russian song that they sing, well, they use that like melody, and that's what I like. Yeah. That's what I remember when I think of this movie.
There's a lot of music. Very loud, clashy, discordant sounded music to me. I mean, I guess this was his thing.
It is very dramatic. Yeah,
it's
I will
very
say that.
Over the top. And our editor, our last person I'm going to talk about as far as crew, our editor, Dorothy Spencer. Isn't it nice to have a woman editor?
There you go.
You don't get a lot of woman crew people.
Don't, even though they were very prevalent in the beginning
of the
film.
Yeah, she was a four-time Oscar nominee, including for Earthquake, Decision Before Dawn, which was a Litvak film, Stagecoach, and Cleopatra.
Oh, that had to be fun.
Yeah, Spencer. It says Spencer was at her best working on action subjects, her cutting instrumental to augmenting the director's work in creating or sustaining the desired level of suspense. Arguably, the most difficult task in her lengthy career was having to pare down the 70,000 feet of film shot for the epic production of Cleopatra to a mere 22,000 feet.
Holy heck.
Yeah, I don't even like to edit the podcast. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, I can't even imagine being a film editor and having to deal with that.
Like, yeah, and not digital. You know, they had to like splice it by hand and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
Some of the other productions she did, The Young Lions, another Montgomery Clift movie, The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, and she also lived to be 93 as well.
That's great.
Sort of like
that's really
our
cool
screenplay writer.
Yeah.
Okay, so this film, they say shot on location, but it says it was also partially shot at a studio in Vienna. So this is not completely on location, though they like to pretend it is. Mm-hmm. Mostly, I think a lot of location, though.
Yeah.
Well, it was done in Austria, that's for sure. Mm.
Definitely wasn't shot on a soundstage.
No, but they did say that the Soviet government had attempted to unofficially pressure the Austrian government to stop the production of The Journey. And Litvak also noted that the film had been subject to severe criticism in the communist press.
I have a feeling that's what happened with the script, with their rewriting of it and wanting it a certain way. I really feel like that they got pressured from that, from maybe not the communists themselves, but maybe studios jumping in and saying, hey,
antagonize Russia in the late 1950s, going into the 1960s. I thought this was interesting. One of our main characters is Yul Brynner. Did you see that during filming, Yul Brynner's hand was cut by a former crazed lover who traveled across Europe to find him there and cut his hand? And then there are scenes when Brenner's bandaged hand is not shown on screen, and there are scenes when he is holding a prop to camouflage his hand.
I'm so mad at myself because I know this fact, but every time I watch this movie, I never pay attention to his hand.
Where is his bandage hand?
Right. And now I need to make it a mission the next time I watch it to look at his hands.
Poor Yul. These crazed lovers running around trying to attack him.
He's too good looking. That's what it is.
Yeah. Did they have no protection back then?
I don't think
anybody
so.
Anybody can just run on set and stab people. Very sadly, this film was a flop at the box office.
I know. It makes me so sad.
And that should not color your feelings on this
film. Yes, please
this
do
film,
not.
It's just,
don't
I'm
let
not
that
sure.
You.
Maybe it was just the wrong time period for this film. It's kind of a weird subject, I suppose.
I suppose. I feel like that maybe this is a part of history a lot of people don't know about. And I don't mean to be horrible in saying this, but I think a lot of people probably don't care about that.
Yeah.
They want to see movies about World War II, which I understand, but at the same time, what's happening? I didn't know much about it either when I first saw this movie, but that didn't really bother me. I still thought it was very dramatic. I still thought it was an interesting conflict that made me think.
Yeah.
But yeah,
there's
I don't
a
know.
Lot more to this film. There's a deeper meaning to this whole film, as a matter of fact, which I will get into whenever we get into the plot. But this resulted in a loss to MGM of $905,000.
They've had worse bombs, I think.
They didn't take kindly to them, though.
No, they
And
don't.
Then another thing I noted, and couldn't find any information out where this was, but they say that Ron Howard's father plays an uncredited soldier very early in the movie.
I read that, too, and that's another reason I'm going to watch it again. I want to see if I can find him.
Was he the soldier that was sticking out his tongue and joking around with him in the one scene by the bus?
Ooh, maybe.
Yeah, I was just wondering that.
It's possible.
All right, let's move on. Do you have any thought on the crew?
Well, when we decided we were going to talk about this, I was excited to look into that. And as soon as I saw the cinematographer, I was like, oh my God, Weddy's going to be in heaven.
Jack Gilbert. Well, he's not Freddie Young.
With the rest of the crew and such, I really don't know too much.
Yeah, same.
About
I wasn't
it's
familiar
like,
with a lot of
it's
these.
Like, it almost does make me want to go to a film school and learn more about that because there is a a process and a science to all of that. And I really wouldn't mind learning what it is, because it's like you said with the editor and her having to edit Cleopatra. I wouldn't even know where to begin in that situation. But obviously that woman was trained and knew what she was doing.
In the business a long time. She started it very young.
Yeah.
And she worked her way up. But you could probably just get a podcast and that will you learn quite a lot doing a podcast.
That's how I do it. Got it. Yeah.
So anyhow, let's go on to the plot if you're ready.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. There's some written words that says, the action of this story takes place between Budapest, the capital of Hungary, and the Austro-Hungarian border, where the film was actually photographed. The time is November 1956. That's nice. Not often do they give you the exact time reference during the tragic days of the Hungarian uprising. So what this kind of is that at this point, Russia was in control of Hungary, is my understanding, similar to like the English in India and all these other places. And originally, I guess, for the protection of the Hungarians, I suppose that's what they seem to state. But then the Hungarians, they wanted to have their country back to themselves. So they started to rebel and so forth. That's my understanding of the backstory of that.
Yeah. In this movie, it is really interesting because you get both perspectives.
Yes.
And you hear both sides. Now, granted, you're listening to a script, but I imagine the writer, the director, I imagine they all had something to say about the situation.
Yeah. And so it kind of starts off at an airport. And did you read this thing about the plane they're showing in the beginning?
Yes, I did read about that.
The plane that they're showing in the beginning, I don't know how soon after, but it went on a flight and wound up crashing and killing all five people aboard.
Yeah, apparently it crashed into the mountains.
Yeah.
I think they said it was like a few years after, something like that.
So it's like, okay.
Like, holy heck.
That's a shame that they spotlighted that particular plane. Well, could they hardly have known that was going to happen, I suppose. But
right.
They show this plane being taxied about, and that's the killer plane. The music here, again, it's kind of...
It's very loud.
It's loud. It's orchestra-like. It's symphonic. It's clashy.
It's very much setting you up for the drama that is this movie.
There's a lot of clashy music and ominous-sounding score, like when something dramatic is going to happen. It's very telegraphing. It's like telegraphing the action, which is not my favorite.
That's fair.
And it's very loud in places.
It is.
Oh, dear God.
It is. Please, yeah, you got to watch your volume.
Tone down a little.
Yeah, you got to watch your volume when you're watching this movie.
So what's going on here basically in this scene is that they're in a Hungarian airport. I guess Budapest airport.
Yeah, they're in Budapest.
And there's Russian officers all over the place. And there's a bunch of passengers that are being held in this airport for an extended period of time because something is going on with this Hungarian uprising and they won't let anybody fly out of this airport for whatever reason.
From what I got is that they were there before the Russians had gotten to that airport. And it just so happens that as they were there to catch their flights, that's when the Russians took over and like suspended all flights. Yeah. That's what I kind of got from
that. Yeah. And there was certain Robert Morley plays Hugh Devereaux was saying at one point, we've been here for days.
Yeah. He was there for 2 days.
Yeah, two days. These people are all sitting around. They're up complaining, you know, this and that. And then they hear on the radio, it's kind of sad. They hear on the radio that the Hungarians trying to radio for help from anywhere else in the world. Like, help, help us, help us. Like very plaintive, please, which is kind of heartrending. But then they're like, well, nothing we can do about it.
Especially because it still resonates today.
Yeah.
Sadly.
Yes. And they just like turn the radio. Nothing we can do.
That's the end of it. Turn
the radio on to some music. Let's listen to some music now. And then the bus comes in and brings our main characters, Lady Ashmore, who is played by Deborah Carr.
Yay.
Deborah Carr, let's talk about her. She's a Scottish actress. She's a 6-time Oscar nominee, no wins.
No wins.
That's so upsetting.
It is. But you know what? In my opinion, it's the people that don't win Oscars that get that a lot of people remember, in my opinion.
She deserved, just for some performances I'll mention that she was nominated for, that she did not win, believe it or not, her performance in From Here to Eternity, The Sundowners, Separate Tables, great in all these films. I don't know what kept going on.
Bad luck.
She did win an honorary Oscar.
I do remember that. I remember watching that as a kid.
They said they gave her, that she got one of the biggest standing ovations of any person that ever won an honorary Oscar.
I was a small child at the time, but my mom was thrilled because I know Deborah Carr through my mom. This is from my mom, by the way. And I remember us watching this Oscar and I remember people standing up and I remember that being a big deal, but it didn't really hit me until I got older exactly what was going on there. Yeah. So it was nice she at least got an honorary Oscar and she gave a really cute short speech.
Yeah. She was originally named Deborah Trimmer. Interesting. Mm. You can see why that might not have been a great name.
Right.
She actually started out as a ballerina and switched over to acting in the stage, and she would go on to act in the West End, which is the Broadway of London.
Right.
And then she would transition to film in Britain. And her role in The Black Narcissus is what brought her to the attention of Hollywood. I thought this was cute. To avoid confusion over pronunciation of her name, Louis B. Mayer, head of MGM, billed her as Car Rhymes with Star.
I love that, too. I never knew that. A couple years ago, I saw it on a YouTube channel that talks about classic film, and they brought that up. And it's like, oh, my God, that's great, because people still debate how to say her name. And yeah. It's like, nope. Right
Car
there.
Rhymes a Star.
Car Rhymes a Star.
And her big stardom in America started when she had back-to-back hit films, King Solomon's Mines, which is a personal favorite of mine.
Great
and
movie.
That film that, for some reason, every time you're here, we have to talk about that I can't say, that's Peter Ustinov plays Nero in.
Oh, Quo Vadis.
Yes.
I think that's how it's said. Yeah.
That's the second time you've had to say that film.
You know, I don't like to talk about that movie either, but for silly reasons, when my mom showed me that movie, well, didn't really show me. She put it on and I watched it. It actually gave me nightmares.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're about to be eaten by lions.
Right. It was horrifying to me
scary.
As a child.
Yeah, it's a little scary. So she plays Lady Ashmore. She's this very prim and proper British lady, which was a very typecasting for Deborah Carr. She
yes.
was always put in these roles when yes. I think she was not quite so prim and proper from what I read about
nope.
Deborah Carr.
She
had a lot of affairs with co-stars,
well,
directors.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was a little bit
well,
of a...
she herself has said in... at least I know of at least one interview where she said she really admired Marilyn Monroe. She wished that she could do that, be that kind of persona, but she just got stuck in the uptight, classy English lady role.
Yeah.
Oh, but I will say real quick, I did watch a couple weeks ago, Rita Moreno was on The View and they talked about her time on The King and I. And she talked about how charming Yul Brynner was. And she had a little story about Deborah Carr. She said that she loved funny underwear that had writings on it. So she would put some on and then she would call Rita into her dressing room and she would lift up her skirt. And she said she wore different ones that all had all kind of funny sayings that are escaping me right now. But yeah, it was really, really cute.
Well, there was a rumor that she was having an affair with Yul Brynner even.
I have also read that.
I mean, why would you not want to?
True. That's you're not wrong. I know I wouldn't say no to that man.
I mean, I have read quotes from her where she certainly spoke out about how she found him very attractive and very magnetic and sexy.
It's so tough. To me, yes. I would say, yeah, something probably happened. But then you hear stories from other people saying they were more like brother and sister.
Yeah.
But you never know.
Anyhow, so Lady Ashmore, Deborah Carr, arrives on this bus with Henry Fleming. Now, Henry Fleming is played by Jason Robards Jr. An interesting thing about that is that this is his film debut, this particular film.
It was.
He is a two-time Oscar winner, Julia and All the President's Men. They were both supporting roles. He had his, like I said, his film debut in The Journey, which is this film. He was in the U.S. Navy in World War II as a radio man, and he had success in Broadway in Eugene O'Neill plays, such as The Iceman Cometh and A Long Day's Journey Into Night. He was a big Civil War buff, they say.
Interesting.
And I think one of the things he's most famous for, strangely enough, is being married to Lauren Bacall.
I suppose. I got to be honest, I don't know much about him. I've only seen a couple of his films.
I haven't seen a lot of his films either.
But if it's one thing I will say about him, I love his speaking voice. He does have a great voice.
Oh, yeah. I never paid that much attention to it. It's really hard to believe in this film that anybody would choose Jason Robards Jr. over Yul Brynner.
That is the main, I think that is one of the biggest problems with this film. And usually most films you watch, they tell you, okay, you want these people to be together. You want her to choose him. But I feel like this movie doesn't do that. This movie wants you to make up your mind. But no, we all want her to be with Yul Brynner.
Yeah,
that's
just
kind of how it is.
Yeah,
like, and it's not that Jason Robards isn't attractive or...
is he?
But compared to Yul Brynner...
yeah, could they not have found somebody that was extremely... yeah, I mean, yeah.
It's
oddly miscast in this film.
Yes, I do feel he is miscast. And it's not that he can't play this part. I love when he does his little speech in the hospital thing.
Yes, that was a very good speech.
But in this situation... yeah, no.
Let's put looks aside. He's not very dynamic. He's always whining and complaining and yelling at her.
You will not see him very much in this movie.
In general.
And when you do, you just want to get him a towel to wipe his sweaty face. Granted, his character is in pain. And you kind of want to just tell him to shut up.
Yeah.
just keep his mouth shut.
Yeah. So the bus arrives with them and they're coming to try to take a flight. Well, guess what? Flights are
all flights canceled, are canceled.
No luck. And you right away get this sense. Well, first of all, Hugh Devereaux, played by Robert Morley, he runs right up to Lady Ashmore. He knows her. He recognizes her. Apparently, he used to know her and her husband.
They met then, 2 summers ago.
Yeah. And then he just says hello to her and tells her that the flights are canceled. And then she runs back to Fleming. And you can see, you get the sense right away that they're not just casual people that have met on a bus, even though that's what they're trying to pretend to be.
They are, yeah.
But it's quite clear that they have some level of involvement and something secretive is going on here. And his presence here is not a normal British subject. He's also pretending to be a British subject.
It's definitely mysterious.
Yeah. So
you already
have a hint that something, there's some intrigue going on.
Yeah.
A little bit more about Robert Morley. He's a British actor. He was nominated for 1 Oscar, Marie Antoinette, which was one of his very earliest roles.
He's
loved
good in that.
Acting since he was in a play in kindergarten. He worked as a beer salesman before attending RADA, which is the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. It was a very prestigious school in England. He did stage work in Britain, eventually getting to Broadway as Oscar Wilde. He played Oscar Wilde, and then that got him his Oscar-nominated role in Marie Antoinette. And
he was very good in that movie.
He was a huge horse racing fan. And Gladys Cooper was his mother-in-law.
No way! Oh my gosh, I love her.
And then he's also known for his role in The African Queen. I think that's a place that I recognized him from right away.
I want to admit the first movie I ever watched with Robert Morley is The Great Muppet Caper. He has a cameo.
Oh, does he?
Yeah. It's when the Muppets land in a pond and they're like, all right, we're in Great Britain.
I saw him in a movie, and now I'm not going to be able to remember what's where he plays an Asian man. And it's so bad.
Oh,
it's
man.
So bad. And he doesn't even remotely try to sound Asian. He sounds exactly like a British man. But I wish I could remember. There's a lot of people that are not playing the proper ethnic roles in that, too. And I can't remember what that was or why I was watching that. But anyhow, that was a very strange movie.
That is.
So then also these people, all these passengers, there's a whole group of them that have been sitting there and they all get kind of schlepped on this bus and sent to Vienna by bus.
I like the Russian guy. We have to get you out by bus.
Yeah, so like they have a driver that's a Russian driver.
Yes.
One of the Russian.
Hungarian. He's a Hungarian.
The Hungarian
driver.
Guy is going to drive them at the behest of the Russians. They're ordering these people to do this. This isn't like a choice.
Yeah, they have to go to
so,
Vienna.
So some of the interesting people on the bus is there's this family, Rhinelander. Rhinelander and Jackson as Margie Rhinelander. That's the mother. Do you know she was born in Millvale, PA?
No, I didn't know that.
Did you know she was the wife of Eli Wallach?
I did not know that either. I don't know much about her. Either. I did like her in this, though.
Yeah, she was the doctor in The Shining as well.
Ah, okay.
But she plays the mother, and then the father is played by
E.G. Marshall,
plays Harold Rhinelander. That's the father. His most famous role was Juror Number 4 in 12 Angry Men.
I believe that.
I wouldn't have even recognized him because I guess he looks the same if you really pay attention, but if you're not really paying attention.
He
looks so much more severe in.
His face is always very familiar to me. I feel like he's one of those actors that's always in the back. It's a background character that you just happen to see. You just never remember. He's a that guy.
So he was the host narrator for some time for CBS Radio Mystery Theater. He is from the Actors Studio, and he apparently was this big prankster, but he also refused to tell people what EG stood for. He would make up all these absurd.
That is great. I love that.
But considering his name was originally Everett Eugene Gruntz, I kind of think I might know what it stands for. But apparently if people would ask him, he would say all these absurd things like...
That's really... Oh my gosh, I love that. It makes me want to change my name to initials.
And then the children. Now, okay, so we've got Ron Howard. We've got Ron
Little
Howard
Ronnie
playing
Howard.
Billy Rhinelander. Boy, is he cute in this film.
Oh my God, he does such a good job.
Cute. This is his first credited film role. He did another role, but he wasn't credited.
Mm-hmm.
He is, of course, a 2-time Oscar winner for Best Director and Best Picture for A Beautiful Mind. Mm-hmm. He, of course, won those as an adult. He's alive. Well, he's a current director.
He's made a career of his own.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, but he is too cute for words in this film.
So good.
And he's like kind of like this, he's a little more bratty of the two children.
Well, he's,
like,
he's the younger of the two, I believe. Yes.
And he's kind of, he's real gregarious.
He acts like a child. Yeah. Like that's what I really love about this movie. In my opinion, there's nobody that does a bad job.
Yeah.
Even the children, there's a baby in this. The baby is good because the baby is crying all the time. That's what a baby would do in that situation.
Not the girl, not the suspicious girl in the... The suspicious girl and the innkeepers, you thought she did good? I thought she was horrible. She was like my least favorite.
Yeah, we can get to it.
Yeah, I will get to her. I have her okay, notes on her.
But I kind of jumped the gun
there. The other brother is called Flip Rylander. His name was Flip Mark. His name was not actually Flip. His name was Philip.
Which I thought was great. I was like, oh, okay, that's probably the only way they could get him to do anything by calling him by his name.
Well, and then apparently I saw that he played another role and his name was Flip in that role too. And I was like, what the heck?
He had a rough time, I guess.
So, but he started out as a child model because they were looking for a boy with red hair and freckles and his mother just had to bring him in and they said, oh yeah, perfect, take him. And he did a couple roles. He was a child actor. I don't really think he really transitioned much into adult actor. He would eventually become a flight attendant and later become a 911 operator and maybe even still to this day, and he is still alive as well.
Oh, wonderful.
So anyhow, that's the family. There's lots of other people that we can get to.
There's quite a group here.
There's
have every nationality you can think of. Yeah. You got French. I can't tell.
Syrian. Remember,
Syrian.
The one guy is Syrian.
Yeah, her husband is Syrian. I get confused, though, by the father with the older daughter. And
yeah, I think
and
they
buttons.
Were the van, right.
Are they part German?
I thought they were either German or they might have been Russian. Because who's he talking to that he wants?
Whenever they're going over the passports, he tells him that he's something, but he's also an Ethiopian.
Von Rocklitz.
He's a professor.
Von Rocklitz.
Yeah.
That's the father. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure. Some of them are vague as to what they are. There is some vagueness in this.
Yeah. So I guess it's not important, but basically you got pretty much an international group of people here.
And we should have said the Rhinelanders are Americans.
I believe you did. Yeah.
Yeah. At one point, he asks her, are you American? And she said, yeah, but don't hold that against
us.
Don't
let that bother you.
Don't let that bother you.
It doesn't
right.
bother me. I was just curious to know.
Oh, like you're going to quote the film.
I can.
Okay. So again, I hear the clashy, discordant music as they travel on the bus, which irritates me, but okay. But it's sort of the weird thing about it is it goes from this clashy, loud, discordant music to nothing to clashy, loud, discordant music to nothing. And it's like, okay, weird. Couldn't we have like some transitional music? I don't know. And then at this point, when they're on the bus, you can see that Fleming is wounded. There's something wrong with him. And then this is when Lady Ashmore is talking to Devereaux on the bus. And then she tells him that she's separated from her husband. Bus comes to a blockade. This is where Ron Howard is making faces at the soldiers outside. And I thought, well, maybe that's the father. I
want to look now. Yeah.
Somebody, everybody can look and see if they think it
might be. See if they can find Ron Howard's father.
But then this is when Fleming passes out. After they take an inventory, Fleming passes out. And he's kind of speaking in a different language. And Lady Ashmore runs to tend to him. And then you see Devereaux starts to get real suspicious and the other passengers are kind of eyeing them like, what's going on here?
Rushed awfully quick to him.
Yeah, everybody's getting a little suspicious of this thing. But then another thing, not just the clashy, discordant music, there's also sometimes like a jaunty tune when the bus is traveling also. Yes. Is that your Russian song?
No. I know what you're talking about. You're right. They have this very intense music, and then it's when they think they're in the clear.
There's
and then it's like,
jaunty.
Oh, a couple minutes to Austria. Then they have this lively
jaunty,
tune that comes out of nowhere. Yeah, it's very – the music is very – it's a huge contrast between this intense, insane, dramatic thing, and then just liveliness, and then you throw in some Russian tunes.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe
it can be distracting. Yeah. I never really thought about it, but now that I think about it, the music can be very distracting.
I mean, there's movies we do where I'm like, there's background music.
I don't even
music,
pay attention.
I don't hear it.
Yeah.
But then this one, I'm like, okay, certainly can hear
you
this
can
one.
You can ignore it in this
one.
Yeah,
this is very obvious.
Nope.
And then after they get over being boarded by the Russians, well, guess what? Now they're going to get boarded by the Hungarians. They can't get anywhere, these poor people on the bus. Then we get introduced to Ava. She's one of the rebel freedom fighters, who is Anouk Amy. Anouk Amy is Oscar nominated for A Man and a Woman. She's known for her Fellini films, especially La Dolce Vita, which is a film we spoke about. It's
that
one of the podcasts here.
Check out that episode if you haven't.
and 8.5. She was a dedicated environmentalist and animal rights activist. She's friends with Jane Goodall, as a matter of fact.
Oh, interesting.
And she is still alive at age 91.
Wow.
And look at me.
I love her in this movie. She doesn't have to say anything.
No, she's very angry.
There's a lot of moments between her and Yul Brynner just looking at one another and you don't need dialogue.
It almost makes me wonder if they had some involvement prior to this conflict because they really are very intense at the way they look at each other. I mean, Yul Brynner is intense at any possible time. But
true.
They very intently look at each other many times and I just wondered if there was a subplot there that maybe they were involved.
Oh, maybe.
Remember, they used to be, as we'll talk about, the Hungarians used to be friends with the Russians.
Right.
So, but it's all changed.
I will say about her, though, I love that she is marked as Ava. I don't remember them ever calling her by name.
No, me neither. Okay. I don't think they ever did.
I'm glad it's not just me.
It's just like these freedom fighters that walk in all serious and very, and I love the line where the Rhinelanders are trying to offer her this chocolate.
Chocolate.
She says, "We need guns, not chocolate." And I just thought, well, that's a great line. It's a great line.
I thought, and her delivery is really good in that, too.
She's very angry throughout this film. Mm-hmm. Just, you can tell she's very angry.
You can tell all of the Hungarians, especially in the village that they're in. Yeah, it's amazing.
So finally, they're coming into this last town before the Austrian border. They're like, "Hoo-hoo, we're going to get into Austria. Everything's fine." Oh, no, we're not. No, we have to stop.
It's called the journey for a reason.
Yeah. But then as they're coming, they see these Hungarian prisoners in the back of a Russian truck. They're being taken, we have to assume, to be executed, I'm guessing.
Or a camp of some kind, I imagine.
I don't think it's a good ending.
It's not looking good for them,
But they're singing this song. Now, is it a national anthem of Hungary, I wonder? I don't know what that song is, but it seems like the sort of place where you would sing a national anthem and all the villagers start to join in. And then I think also at this point, the church bells are ringing. I don't know if this is the exact part. Oh, there's a church bell ringing thing that happens several times in this film that I noticed.
I did not notice that.
It happens a couple times. I don't know if this is exactly where the church bells ring. But now we're going to see our friend, Major Suroff.
That's a great entrance.
Yeah, on his black horse.
Comes riding in on horseback.
He's in black. Yul, so very dramatic. So it's Yul Brynner, of course. Yul Brynner, and he is an Oscar winner for The King and I. Mm. He is known for The Magnificent Seven, The Ten Commandments, and Westworld. He was born in Russia. His father left when he was young. He would learn the guitar and sing, as well as perform as an acrobat in his teenage years. He suffered a fall from the trapeze that nearly killed him and caused him a serious back injury that started him on a narcotics addiction in his teens. Eventually, in his late teens, he received extensive treatment for the addiction and reportedly never used drugs again.
Wow.
He would eventually come to the United States. He started out on Broadway, but he did not have much success there because of his lack of English. He would do TV directing for several years in the late 1940s, and he would then be asked to audition for the role of Broadway musical The King and I, which he agreed to and which made him very famous. He was also an accomplished photographer, spoke 11 languages. His daughter Victoria was godchild of Audrey Hepburn, and he always prepared breakfast wearing a silk kimono.
Oh, what a man.
Preparing us breakfast in his silk kimono?
Oh, my God.
Yul?
Yes, please.
And of course, I mean, I think we know Yul Brynner has incredible screen presence.
Oh,
you can't take your eyes off that
Absolutely.
Man.
Absolutely. He was meant for the screen, yes.
He's just this dominant, intense man.
I have to be honest, though. I really would have, if I would have had the opportunity, I would have loved to have seen him on stage, see what he's like on stage. But yeah, he definitely has the best screen presence.
I saw some sort of an interview with him one time where he said that he was doing The King and I on stage and he was in the middle of doing some role and these two ladies were in the front row laughing and he actually stopped and reprimanded them.
That's awesome.
And told them to be quiet.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And I was like, yeah, can you imagine if you were those ladies? I'd be like, yes, sir. Yes, sure, Yul.
You'd be like, oh, my God.
Yes, Mr. Brynner, we'll be quiet.
Oh, my God.
It'd be terrifying. So he arrives on his black horse, and the passengers get off the bus. Now they're sent in this room. He's collecting their passports. They're going to be delayed again. They have a new procedure. He's very personable, Major Suroff, with all the people. And he's
a soldier that follows orders.
Yes.
That's
he makes
what his
that
character
clear.
Is.
Yes.
Yes.
And Deverell is acting as the spokesperson for the group. Suroff tells them, you can either wait here to get your clearances, or you can go back to Budapest. And all the group is like, we don't know, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, Lady Ashmore almost yells.
Yeah.
oh, I think we should stay here. And you get this really nice camera pan right to her. And the people part like it's the Red Sea. And she comes, yeah, she comes. And Yule is suddenly like.
He is a smitten kitten.
Yes, he's very interested.
It's very much written on his face, too. He does such a good job with
it. And there's this sort of subtext between them when they're talking that what they're saying does not necessarily match up. She says, I would rather wait here. And he's like, you would. And he gives her this little up and down look, too. And she kind of looks down in a way. And there's definitely something going on between them. And then he starts quizzing the passengers.
He goes over their passports.
Yeah, he goes over the passports. He's asking.
I actually do enjoy this scene because you're now also getting an introduction to all these side characters.
Yeah.
To all these side characters. And it is very crucial to the plot, in my opinion.
Yeah. They go through this process. But you notice when he calls Fleming up, he doesn't really even ask him questions. He just says, this is Fleming.
He just flips through his book.
Kind of throws it aside and says, okay, everybody can go.
Yeah.
Which is odd. Now, okay, so they go to the hotel. When the innkeeper comes out, they have this light, silly music for the innkeeper where he's rushing around trying to get. Now, here's this girl I'm talking about. Quiet, lazy, insolent girl, I call her. She doesn't really have a name, to my knowledge. Mm. She was played by a lady named Barbara von Nady, who was a Hungarian countess but had to flee because her family was persecuted by Soviets because they were fighting against the aristocrats. And since she was aristocrat, they were persecuting her family.
Oh, wow.
Yes, this Barbara von Nady. But she's the one person, I don't care for her. I don't really think she does much of anything except look sly and weird the whole time, which maybe that was what she was supposed to do.
I'm pretty sure that's just what her character is for.
She's very mysterious, but you can see that you get the sense that she is going to be some sort of trouble.
Oh, yeah. Like yeah, absolutely.
She looks very sly.
Her character, I suppose it could have been cut, but she does.
Well, she has an important role later on, actually. Yeah. She does something. Yeah, it doesn't show her doing this, but I believe that she does something.
Right.
So, but anyhow, just the way she's behaving, she's very insolent.
She reminds me of like the sullen teenager working for her uncle that doesn't really want to do anything.
I wrote girl working daughter. Who are these women that are
they
with
never
him?
Really
are
say.
They his daughters? I just assumed they were his daughters, but I don't even know.
I didn't even. To me, they're just people that work for him.
Yeah, I don't know.
Chepagay,
yes. And Chepagay, I have some stuff about Chepagay.
I love him. He's a delight.
He's an Austrian actor. He got his start with Max Reinhardt. He had many character roles. He was an American soldier in World War II.
I like him. I really enjoyed him in this. He's definitely the plucky,
He's kind of deferential to the Russians, but also...
He plays a middleman, really.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. It's like he's always going between everybody to try to appease everybody. He's a very big appeaser. That's what.
I think a lot of it is just a survival thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
So then after Deverell winds up confronting Lady Ashmore about Fleming says... Hey, what's going on with this guy? Something's up. He's been suspicious the whole time.
Right.
And he says the other passengers could be jeopardized if there's something going on. And she continues to pretend like she doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah, she doesn't know what he's talking about.
And then they get split up and the women and men are split up and they're all arranged by threes or fours in rooms. Even the husband and wife, Rhinelander,
they
get split up. Yeah, because she's in the room with Lady Ashmore.
Yep.
Fleming is too sick to come to dinner. So Lady Ashmore goes to tend to him and that girl is snooping around. That lazy girl.
She lets them know that dinner is ready.
Yes. And then she's
just
so
looking
suspicious.
Around.
And Fleming is suspicious of her. He's like, is that girl gone? Go
double check. Make sure she's gone.
And then
she,
you know, winds up kissing him. And now we realize, you know, they're obviously romantically involved.
They are in
which
love.
I think we kind of,
and Fleming is actually, he actually is suffering from a bullet wound that hasn't properly healed yet. Yeah.
Yep. And he's all bleeding. He's all bandaged
And actually,
up.
I believe the bullet is still inside him. I think they take it out.
Yes, they take it out later. Yes, they do. Yep. And then they go down. Everybody's at the thing to dine. And the major and the Russian officers come in to dine with the passengers, which shocks them. They weren't expecting that. They get this sort of...
He did say, would you take a chance of being my guest?
They get this sort of astonished, kind of frightened look or miserable look on their face.
They do look intimidating because they like...
They burst into the dining room with their uniforms and everything. And of course, right away, Sir Uff says, people are missing here. Where is everybody? And then at that point, Lady Ashmore walks in and he says, somebody else is still missing. And she tells him it's Fleming.
13 is an unlucky number.
He keeps questioning her and she winds up spilling her drink very clumsily.
You can tell she starts to get nervous keeps asking questions and she finally knocks over her drink.
And then there's some machine gun fire outside, but the major is not concerned. He's starting to philosophize. He doesn't understand why the Hungarians have gone against the Russians. This is a thing he talks about frequently.
He gives many speeches.
They zoom in a lot to close-ups. He was about to say something very important in this film, I noticed. And you'll see those camera pans that they said that Litvak likes to do, because he'll come in a room and he'll be able to walk the whole length of the room and the whole length of the set, and the camera will just follow him, and you know it's on a crane.
Right.
You're just taking one big long panning shot, kind of a la Touch of Evil, you know?
Right.
But I do also like the way it will zoom in for a close-up right as he's about to say something very important. And they do that many times throughout the film, I noticed.
Mm.
The poor major's trying to force these people to talk to him. You get the sense that he's very lonely, and he wants to have people justify his actions against the Hungarians. He keeps trying to provoke them into talking, or even to say anything.
This is one of the things that I really enjoy about this character in general. Not even just Yul Brynner playing him, but just the character in general. This is very much a military man who spent most of his life in the military, taking orders, being given orders, telling others to do his bidding. And at this point in the story, in his life, you can tell he's exhausted. He's exhausted by it, and he wants nothing more than actual proper human interaction.
Yeah.
And it's to the point where they're all terrified of him, and he realizes this, and he tries to provoke them. And he even gets into it with Devereaux, and he's like, what if I tried to provoke you into a fight? What if I was one of the mean ones? And he realizes that he goes too far at one point. But to me, it's such a great character arc. I just really enjoy
it. There's a lot of underlying stuff in his character. And Yul Brynner does a great job of bringing that out subtly and also internalizing it, but showing you in his face that it's internalized.
Like, if anything, he will tell you of how frustrated. But you can see it. You can see it on his face. The man is just desperate to live like a normal human being.
And then Lady Ashmore tells him that they hate him very abruptly.
He's like, he says, I want an honest opinion. And she looks at him and says, they hate you.
And then he says, thank you. And then after that, there's machine gun fire. There's rebels on the roof. One is killed. The villagers gather around the killed person. And this is one of the first times that we were talking about. The major comes over to see, and that's when Ava and he exchange these intense stares. And this happens many times throughout the film.
What I really love about that scene is how, when the gunfire first starts, how chill him and his two officers are. The bullets start hitting the windows, and he's like, all right, everybody get down. We'll go outside.
He's like, yes, let me take care of this. But he seems to indicate, why are they shooting at us? He's bewildered by this whole hostility by the Hungarians.
Yeah, he's not understanding their point of view.
And then poor Mr. Fleming is back in his room. He's sick. He's moaning and screaming in Hungarian. And everybody is now knows something fishy is going on. Lady Ashmore goes up to see him, and the other men in the room are now aware, hey, this guy, there's something going on. This guy's an escaped something. And the one guy, the Syrian guy, wants to turn him in. He's like, I'm going to turn him over to the major. Yeah. And Devereaux's trying to keep them like, no, stop this, blah, blah, blah. And then Lady Ashmore and Devereaux have a little scene in this kitchen where she tells him the story of Fleming.
She finally gives the details.
Their involvement, apparently. Before they even get into the story, and there's an interesting interruption where, as she's starting the story, you see this shadow on the pavement. First, you hear the hooves. You don't even see anything, but you hear those hooves real loud, real noticeable. This is where I wonder about the sound, where they said that Litvak liked to prioritize sound over dialogue.
Oh, okay.
So you hear these horses' hoofbeats.
You do, yeah.
And then you look out, and in shadow, you see the major and the horse.
That he's riding his horse up and down.
And even Devereaux makes something. Oh, I guess the major can't sleep either.
Yep.
And it just puts a little interruption right before she's starting to tell the story of Fleming, which I thought was really interesting.
I think I like that part too. It's almost reminding everybody, here's the shadow.
Like he's looming
figure over this whole story.
Yes. Yep. And so what she basically says is this guy, Fleming, is actually a Hungarian with some other name that I didn't note.
Paul Kedish.
Yes, yeah. And he was a biologist. He was in Britain. He was brought over by some other professor. They don't really say why, but something to do with probably biology. And apparently she has some affair with him. We assume she was still with her husband. And then she doesn't go into a lot of detail. It's very vague the way she speaks.
You basically get bullet points as to their relationship.
That's what it's like.
And it happened during the summer, and by the end of the summer, she ended it.
And then so when he came back to Hungary, and then apparently he was writing a letter to England to try to find out information about her. And that's what wound up getting, maybe not getting him arrested, but that's what sort of put the nail in the coffin. They said, you're a spy, you're writing to the English. And they tortured him. And she starts to break down because she apparently feels responsible that she's caused this to happen to him.
Right. Yeah. When you see this character, he's wearing a black glove on his hand. Mm-hmm. And she reveals that the reason why he's wearing is because his fingernails were torn off.
Yep. Oh, yeah, gross.
Yeah, just horrifying.
So, yeah, but she's clearly emotionally upset about, she feels completely guilty, like she's the cause of this whole thing. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that when Seroff walks in this one building, I believe he's going to this office. There's a good camera pan here, if you're paying attention as he's walking, the camera's just following him.
Yes.
It's really beautiful panning.
It is.
And then that girl.
You hear the typewriter.
That girl is there. You hear
click, 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 and he turns and it pans to her.
And there's that devious girl I don't like. And she tries to kiss him and he pushes her away. And then I said, is she a spy for the Russians? That's what I wrote.
No, I just took it as a teenage girl that was enamored with him.
But
like
you don't
all
think
of us.
That they had a previous relationship. I think they had some previous involvement.
I don't think so.
They said at some point in this film that the major, something about the major and women, all the women.
That was somewhere else, though. I didn't think it was where they were at the moment.
No, they were talking about, well, they were talking about Major Seroff. I don't know.
Oh, well, yeah. But when they asked him about the major, they said that he
like the
was
women
taking over. I thought it was a different town. I didn't think it was where they were.
Well, yeah, I just thought they indicated that women.
To me, it seemed like this was their first encounter because.
I didn't think so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. To me, it seemed like it was a first encounter.
And he, like, took her face and shoved her.
Because he kind of, for a split second, he thinks about it.
For a split second, he's going to.
And then he's like, here, kid.
And then he pushes her away. I don't know. I feel like, because she says something about, that woman is so pretty, too. Like, I just feel like there's some involvement.
Oh, no.
Previous involvement.
From the way
him.
She was speaking, it seemed like she was just talking about him, that he was a very beautiful looking man, that's what I thought.
No, she was talking about Deborah Carr.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Lady Ashmore.
Oh, okay. Oh.
I think she was jealous. She noticed his interest in her.
Oh.
And she's jealous. That's why she wants to cause so much trouble for her.
Ooh, I need to watch that again now.
Anyhow,
I'm going to watch this.
I could be
I'm watching this again anyway. So
then after this, all this happens, there's a new order that comes up. No guns allowed. Report any suspicious people. And that makes, of course, the people very nervous because now they have a suspicious person in their midst. Mm-hmm. And what happens is they gang up on Lady Ashmore when Deverell is away. Mm-hmm. And they're asking her if Fleming is Hungarian. And she basically says, yeah, he is.
Yeah, she finally admits it, yeah.
And then they have this big argument amongst themselves about turning him in. And then the Russian officers come in and throw them all out. And then they have to fill out these forms now for their exit visas. And again, Seroff says, well, somebody's missing again.
13.
Where is this person? And again, Lady Ashmore says, well, it's Mr. Fleming. And then she says she's going to fill out his forms for him. And he says, well, do you know him that well? Because if you make a mistake, that could be bad. And she gives him this look and she says, maybe you could help me fill out
the
forms.
Well, if you help me fill out the forms.
Come on, Major.
I love that part.
Let's go over to your office, Major, and fill out these forms together.
It's so obvious, but she's so good at still kind of keeping it a little bit on the subtle side. Yeah, I love that. It's like, oh, get it, Deborah Carr.
So that then they go into the office to fill out the forms, and that's when he starts telling her his suspicions of Fleming. He starts interrogating her, but then he gets distracted because of the, you see this funeral procession outside, and he goes to the window and he becomes very distracted. And then he again starts talking about how he's trying to justify the Russian presence in Hungary, and he doesn't understand why the Hungarians hate him and how nobody talks to him now. Again, he seems very lonely.
And she 100% doesn't know their perspective, but she's trying to give him some. And it's almost like he doesn't quite want to see their perspective.
No.
You know how some people are? They just, well, I know this is the right way. And then they can't even bother to think about why the other person would think so differently.
I think he doesn't want to think of their perspective because then he'll feel like he's doing something wrong.
Right.
And he's trying to protect
himself.
And he's
been told he's a good soldier.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's trying to protect himself. Yeah. That's what I think he's
doing. Yeah, that's very good.
Then he goes in, after they're done filling out the forms, he goes in and asks the group if they understand the orders about concealing suspicious persons. And then he's looking around, who can I interrogate? Who can I pick on? Poor Mr. Avron with his
Simon Avron
with his asthma. I have some notes about Mr. Simon Avron, actually.
I love that shot when she's walking out of the room and turning the corner, but she's still looking at them through the window and she's watching him pick who he's going to talk to next. Yeah. I love that
like,
shot.
Who's going to divulge? Who's going to spill
gonna
the beans?
Tell me everything?
So he picks Mr. Simon Evren, played by David Kossoff. His son, Paul Kossoff, was a musician in a band called Free. Ah. His band members would leave Free and form the band Bad Company.
Oh.
And Paul was addicted to drugs and would die in his mid-20s, causing David to be an advocate against drug use for his entire life.
Oh, my. Wow.
Yeah.
He's very good in this, too.
Yeah, he is very good.
Fantastic.
So the poor guy, he's questioning. Siroff is questioning him. He's terrified.
Siroff picked
guys.
The right guy.
And he says, he tries to bribe him by saying he can leave.
We can
he
get
says
you
he
out of here.
No, he says, I can't tell you. And then he's like, you can't tell me? And he's like, I don't know. And
yeah,
then
he botched that.
Yeah, and then there's another good zoom in on Siroff when he's making some proclamation. He tells him, oh, you can go, but it's clear. But he's by his expression that he now, really, you know,
he knows that something's up. He just has to find it.
And he goes straight up to Fleming's room. Lady Ashmore's there, of course. He says, I need to speak to him alone. Do you mind if you leave? And then there's this sort of head-to-head.
Now he has her take down the forms.
Oh, yeah.
She's like, here are the forms. Oh, you can go take them down to the officer.
He's like, you don't mind if I talk to your friend here. But there's a big head-to-head battle with Siroff and Fleming, a verbal battle. The two of them do really good off each other, I feel like.
Yeah.
The verbal battle between Jason Robards and Yul Brynner, play really well.
Yeah, that's a great scene, the two of them talking to each other and how he's trying to fool him.
They're fencing.
Yeah, yes, fencing with words.
They're verbally
fencing. And their eye contact.
But then Siroff is going to go storm off, but then Fleming, he needs water. He's having a problem, and the major goes over and helps him. He's trying to help him. He pulls him up. But as he pulls him up, there's a gun under the pillow. He takes the gun. He doesn't see anything. And then when Lady Ashmore comes back, all of a sudden they realize the gun is missing, and they know they have a good suspicion where it may have gone.
They know that they're effed. I like whenever all the other guests are talking to her while Deverell's away, and the father character says, you didn't fool us. You won't fool the Russians.
Yes. So they think we've got to get out of here. That's their thought process.
Right.
So Lady Ashmore, she goes to the innkeeper.
Chepike.
He says, who can we trust? And she picks this guy. Why? I don't know why exactly. It didn't seem very trustworthy to me, but I guess he was because she asked him for help, and he sends her to the fish market to talk to this man that will apparently take them away to freedom. And she goes there to discuss the escape. They're talking in this interesting code at the fish
Sapobaje.
Fish market. But then the Russian army men come up to her and ask her for a passport, which of course she doesn't have.
She doesn't have her documents.
It was given to Major Siroff. She tries to tell them that. Well, they don't understand, and they take her under arrest. And then poor Major Siroff has to go and get her. And now he's really mad. He's driving around in the Jeep like, what are you doing at this place? What are you doing away from the hotel? And then this is a really interesting part, too, where he's driving the Jeep and he comes to a stop and all these Hungarian people are just blocking his way. Like, they're not saying anything to him. They're just standing in the way of his Jeep and staring at him. And
just
again,
looking.
Ava and the Major locking eyes. And eventually he actually has to back up and go around. He goes the opposite way that he was going. And he winds up taking Lady Ashmore to this bar, and he basically says, hey, I know you're lying. Here's the gun. And she tries to make some story up about, oh, you know, the Englishmen, they have to protect themselves. He's like, this is a Russian gun.
English.
This is a Russian gun, lady. And she's like, oh. And he tells her he knows what's going on. He was planning to do all these things, but then he sort of confesses his feelings to her in a very roundabout way, not a very direct way, but a way that we all know that that's what he means.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't respond in kind.
Right.
And then in the meantime, the innkeeper, they go back to the inn, and the innkeeper tells her, yeah, everything's set. Be ready to go at 9:00. We're going to take Fleming first because he's going to be slower. And then she should stay downstairs to avoid suspicion. And then they'll come get her. So it's all this big plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're back at dinner, and the major comes in with his soldiers. And this time he makes them say good evening in English to everybody. And then they start to play music, and he starts doing his philosophy about music then.
Mm.
And Lady Ashmore seemed rather surprised at some of the things he's saying.
He gets very deep.
Yeah, and he's like, well, what are you surprised about? You don't think that I'm a man?
For music.
Yeah, just this Russian soldier. And then he toasts to the music, but Lady Ashmore doesn't toast, and he notices that.
Oh, I love that part with the song and the
toast.
Yeah,
okay, yeah, this is actually one of my favorite parts of the movie. When he gets a little cup, pours vodka, and it puts on like a little pillow or something.
It looks like a plate, an upside down plate.
Yeah, and he and the other two Russian soldiers go over to the ladies. They're only going to the ladies.
Yeah, they go over to the
ladies. So they start with Mrs. Rhinelander, and they sing this little Russian song. It's a really catchy, cute song. I don't know what it means.
I think...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Dun, 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 dun,
when, they do the repetition, I think that's drink. Drink
and
in Russian.
Because they ask the lady's name, and they wind up saying the name. Yeah. It's like, da, da, da.
I know,
da,
I'd love to let... I really should look into that. I want to know what that song is.
It's a really cute song. I know. Yul Brynner is a great singer to begin with. God, and it's just so cute the way
you hear him
sing,
do it in Russian.
Oh. Yeah, the way he sings the song in Russian to these ladies.
Yeah, and they go
at the end of the thing when the song's done, they're supposed to pick up the glass
and drink it.
Chug it. And I guess he's forgotten that Mrs. Rhinelander is pregnant and he's giving her this huge glass of vodka. But okay, I guess that's all right back in 1959.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe that's something, maybe pregnant women in Russia drink vodka.
Maybe they do. So she downs this glass and then she throws the glass on the floor and her husband's like, what are you doing? He's all up. And then he goes about and does this to, you know, some other people.
To the French woman. Wife,
and then he comes over to her car.
Diana.
But before he does that, before he offers it to the French lady, he goes, see, this is very important. He goes over, he says, well, there's another way to drink. And he picks up the shot glass with his mouth and puts it upside down so it drains his mouth. And then he bites the glass and breaks it. And it said that somebody had done an interview one time with Ron Howard. He was really impressed with Yul Brynner throughout the entire film. He was fascinated by him. And when he saw them do that, break the glass, he was really impressed and astonished and he couldn't believe it. And Yul had taken him aside afterwards and said, that's just a prop made of sugar. He said, don't ever try to bite into a glass.
Yeah, he did that on a podcast in 2016 with Marc Maron.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he talked about he was 5 years old and he was just so enamored of seeing him do this really cool thing. I think they had multiple takes. And finally, Yul Brynner did go over and was like, don't eat glass.
Don't eat glass.
It's just a prop.
That happens before. And when he bites the glass, blood starts coming out of his mouth. And Lady Ashmore is disgusted by that. And
it is like, ugh.
Yeah. And that makes him kind of mad. And then he goes.
He says, this is good for my indigestion.
Yeah. But offers the drink to the French lady, and then he eventually comes back to Lady Ashmore. And as he's doing this whole little dance, the whole time the innkeeper behind his back trying to give her signals. So she's trying to pay attention to him and not look at it, but she's getting real distracted. But eventually, then they start dancing. That's very lively.
Yeah, he ends up making it a party, and it's really what it's for him. What it is it's a goodbye party because
he
absolutely intends to let them all go the next day.
Yeah, and so. They're all dancing, but Lady Ashmore's not. She's sitting at a table. She's very anxious.
You can tell she's very stressed. She's very anxious. She's smoking constantly. She's biting her finger or her nail.
She's worried about Fleming getting away, first of all, I think. And Rhinelander, the wife asks Rhinelander, go get me a glass of water. He goes into the kitchen to get a glass, and he's just looking out the kitchen window. He sees Fleming sneaking away. And he feels some sort of way about that. And then when he comes back, the wife is like, what's wrong with you? And he won't tell her. But then the innkeeper's like, okay, he's telling her secretly. Fleming's away. Your turn is coming up next. And then Devereaux comes over and says, oh, the other passengers want to give up Fleming. And she tells him, we're escaping. Don't worry. And he says, well, I don't think that's a good idea. And then Seraph comes over and asks Lady Ashmore to dance with him. Then he tells her it's a farewell party and they're trying to dance. And she does not want to dance with him. She wants to escape because she's supposed to be leaving.
And he's drunk. He is drunk.
Yeah. And he's
off
really,
his ass.
He's really sort of trying to smush her against him. And
he's trying to do everything to hold on to her as long as he can.
I thought one of the interesting things, though, he was saying when he was going on about, again, talking about just doing this philosophy thing that he does throughout. I don't remember exactly what he's speaking about, but he says at one point, like picking flowers on a battlefield. And I thought that was there's some very interesting lines.
I love that little speech. And he's like, and all the time through all the injuries and stuff, the army has been my wife. Something about her being a bitch. And tonight I'm cheating on her. And it's like, oh my God. Like the writing is so good in this.
Yeah, there is. There's some speeches that are maybe a little over the top, but then there are little lines here and there that are really, really just great lines.
I also, real quick, love whenever they're going over the papers with the passport and he says, and I love the line when he says, well, this Mr. Fleming is a mystery. He comes from nowhere and is going nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah, no. So Lady Ashmore eventually gets very upset and pushes him away and runs away. And she's having this breakdown in the hall.
Well, he kind of won't let her go.
Yeah, no, he was being very aggressive towards her. And as she's having this breakdown in the hall, who's standing in the corner?
That girl.
I hate her. And then she goes up and she makes it look like somebody's in Fleming's bed. She comes out and boom, there's Major Suroff right there. It's
waiting
a really nice cut.
I believe he even has a cigarette in his hand,
too. The way they cut the close up there, really impactfully done. It almost makes you jump yourself.
Yeah, you're like, oh, okay.
But he wants to apologize and he says something about people waving and nobody waves back. He has this very long monologue here, too, where he says all this stuff.
Anything goes when people are saying goodbye for the last time.
Yeah, he's talking about goodbyes. Yeah. That's right. And talking about goodbyes. And that's a pretty good monologue there. And then he sort of gets her in this corner and he says, now you know what it's like to feel trapped, as if insinuating that he feels trapped, which I think it means he feels trapped. Mm-hmm. In his position as a soldier in the Russian army, in this situation,
in her presence,
he's forced to do this duty that he doesn't want to do. He's trapped in this.
He's flirting with her, seducing her as hard as he can. And he's just begging for her to just put her arms around him and kiss him. And she won't. You just see the frustration in his eyes.
Yeah. And he's admitting all these things about himself in a roundabout way, showing how vulnerable he is. And she just doesn't care.
Nope.
She has no sympathy for him.
No,
or she does,
she
doesn't. She can't let herself, or I don't know what. But he gives her the gun back. He says farewell. She goes to the pier, but who sees her leaving?
The girl.
That girl.
Oh, you forgot my favorite line. He hands her the gun with my compliments. No flowers. It's November.
Oh, I didn't know. Yeah,
I love that part.
See? Yeah, he says all these very witty lines, to be honest.
Yeah. So
my suspicion is that girl ran and told the major.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. That was my thought. It doesn't show her doing that, but that's what I thought.
It's like in the plan, it is mentioned that Chepige is supposed to wait, like, I think a half an hour, 40 minutes, and then he was going to go to the major and tell him.
Yeah.
But he doesn't even have to. I think the girl
went and told him, because she gets to the boat. They start across the water and there's some Russian troops, a platoon. They kind of have to stop. They go into these reeds. In this scene, I noted there was a lot of outdoor noises. No music. No,
yes.
Very strong outdoor noises. And
it's almost like the film finally decided, okay, we have to be quiet now because we don't want them to get caught.
Yeah. And you hear sort of these crickets chirping, the sound of the water, the boat in the water.
Yeah,
and
the sound is fantastic.
And like I said, this clop, 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 clop.
You hear the horse coming.
What does that mean? We know that means the major is coming. It's very foreboding with that horse clopping. Mm. He's looking in the reeds, and they literally just left. So I'm telling you, that girl ran and told him.
Oh, yeah.
And he can't see them in the reeds, so he goes over and tells the army guys to shine a spotlight, and then he sees them, and he tells them to stop, and she starts freaking out. She says, don't stop, go, go, go. She's trying to tell this poor guy, the fishing guy, to row, and then he just tells them to open fire, and then they all have to duck down, and eventually Fleming says, stop shooting.
He's the one that gives in.
Stop shooting, because he was worried that she was going to get killed. I think the fishing guy gets killed.
According to the report that you see getting typed up, it's written that he got killed.
So he's trying to protect her, and as they're going out, she's trying to protect him. She's trying to protect her. There's all this chaos, screaming. She's trying to follow him.
You hear Deborah Carr screaming a lot, which is very rare in a film.
She's hysterical.
Yeah.
She's trying to follow him, and then the major won't let him, and she starts saying all these horrible things to Major Suroff. She hopes the enemy tears him to pieces.
Yep.
Blah, blah, blah. She's being very mean to him.
Yeah.
And then the Russian troops come to the hotel, and then everybody is not allowed to leave the hotel.
This is when it gets for real.
The Russian army men were harassing the daughter of the one man.
Oh, I think that was a bit of a mistake on her part. She tries to kind of run away and
she's being overdramatic.
It does get very serious. For everybody.
And then the other people are just starting to fight amongst themselves because everybody's on edge and mad.
Because at this point, they don't know what's going to happen.
Well, they know that they left and they're like, well, why did they do this? They didn't tell us they were leaving and blah, blah, blah. Suroff finally sends the passports away that he was supposed to do in the first place. And then he dictates that letter that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And Lady Ashmore is told to go to the hotel, and she starts to plead with Major Suroff, please let me see Fleming. And he doesn't like this, because he doesn't like the romance.
No, he's done at this point.
Yeah, he's very jealous of this situation. And then he tells her they're all leaving for tomorrow. He is waiting for orders and he shall obey. That's what he says.
Yep.
And then there's a new man from headquarters. This man. I love this guy.
He is
so ridiculous. There's this new man from headquarters questioning the passengers. He's eating this
huge sandwich.
This huge sandwich.
It is distracting. I will say that.
He's eating this gigantic sandwich. He's very
Don't be hungry
tiresome
when you watch this movie.
And he's also very tired of everything. He seems very...
And it's like,
point out.
I feel like he was supposed to be more serious, but... That's not how it comes off in this scene.
And also, what is that accent he's having there? That does not sound Russian at all. That sounds like some bizarre... Well, first of all, apparently this guy, Charles Rainier, is a German actor. His father was a doctor who killed himself when Charles was 10.
Oh, jeez.
He appeared in 135 films between 1949 and 2000. He has a lot of character roles like this. But his accent is very strange.
Yeah,
and he's really, I haven't slept in 6 days or whatever he's talking about. Really,
you people get to really, sleep in nice warm
he's a
bed.
He's a very strange character, this guy.
Yeah, it's like, I feel like he was supposed to be more serious than what
he doesn't even seem scary. He just seems world weary and tired.
It's that guy that come to
he's
get
just
interviews
like, oh,
and confessions
deal. I gotta deal with these freaking people. Give me a sandwich, you know.
That sandwich is huge.
Give me a ginormous sandwich.
They literally cut a loaf of bread in half and I think he doesn't even eat the one half, but then he packs up to
he packs it up. And then the next day he says that the passengers are gonna be taken back to Budapest now. And then everybody's upset about that, and then you see Fleming being tended by the doctor. Suraf comes in with the headquarters man to get a statement. And of course, Fleming assumes he's going to be tortured. He's making all these statements. So the headquarters guy was just like, he's not going to say anything. Bye. I'm leaving. I'm out of here. You deal with him.
Yeah.
And I guess the headquarters guy expected Suraf to torture him.
Right.
To get the information out of him.
Because he said, will you talk? And he said no. And he was like, everybody talks. And he walks away.
Take care of it.
So that's what I thought too. Yeah.
So this is the big speech that Jason Robards has. It's a very, very impactful, dramatic speech. And the way Yul Brynner is listening to him, it's really a very important, poignant scene, I think.
Mm. Oh, yeah, it's beautiful.
Where they both start to understand each other. The enemies understand each other, and they are enemies but not enemies.
Right.
And at one point, Suraf was wiping his brow.
Yeah.
And when he takes the bullet out.
While he's giving the speech, he's having a bullet removed from his body.
And after the bullet comes out, he leans his head on Suraf's hand and says, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great really scene. Something. It's
so
really
good.
Something.
Yeah. I almost wish the two of them could have worked together. I don't think they did. But I wish they could have, because they really had a good.
They had a good. Yeah. A good back and forth between the two of them.
Very impactful.
So the passengers are now gathered in a room, and Mrs. Rhinelander, what a lovely lady. She makes a speech about how these women have come to a decision. She tells Lady Ashmore that she got everybody into this mess, and she's the reason they're being held up here, and that she knows that Major Suraf has a thing for Lady Ashmore, and everybody has been talking about it behind her back. And then she goes on further to say that she thinks Lady Ashmore should give Major Suraf what he wants so that they can go. And then she starts crying and try to guilting her, talking about her baby.
It's a very big, I don't know if I want to say not really climactic, but maybe amongst these people it is. Because pretty much after this, it's all downhill from there with them. But yeah, this is basically the major point with all the other passengers that they are just like completely done. And they all honestly don't know what's happening. And they very well could be put in jail. And I think it's just an act of desperation. Yeah. And I actually kind of like her little outburst, because she was pregnant also at the time. And I think that makes sense. You're in such a stressful situation. Your family has a possibility of being split up, threatened, killed.
Yeah.
And I actually like it.
Go pour yourself off to this major.
Well, there are worse things though.
Well, I mean, it is Yul Brynner. What if it was the headquarters guy? That would have been much worse.
Right. Yeah. It's like, there are worse things to
ask she's happy to be with Jason Robards. I don't see how she can object to Yul Brynner.
I know. When you think about the situation, it's like, okay, that is horrible that they're asking her to do that. Yeah. But because Yul Brynner's such a good looking man, it's like, is it really that bad of a thing?
That's no sacrifice. That's no sacrifice.
It's fine.
And then there's the clashy loud music and these gunshots. And then you see Major Suraf and the horse, and the horse has fallen down. He's hurt.
His horse was hit with gunfire. Yeah.
And then right at this time, he winds up taking the horse into the stables, and that the same doctor that was tending to Fleming is now tending to the horse.
Is now tending to the horse.
And he's upset. Of course, we don't know what the fate of the horse at this point, but he's upset. He goes into the other room to have a drink. the other soldiers pour him a drink and they're playing accordion.
Well, what I really love about that scene is when he walks into this bar and sits down, the guy that's the bartender, I think it's just another soldier, but he's also a bartender. He's preparing him a drink and it seems like the other soldiers want some, but he kind of lets them know that that's not his decision.
Yeah.
So he gives Yul Brynner some, Yul Brynner drinks some, and then he tells him, give them to everybody else.
Everybody. Yep, that's true. He does do that. And he sings along with the accordion really sadly. And then he looks at this picture of him and the horse and the Hungarians that are now fighting him. And
they're
all
together. That gave him that horse.
That gave him the horse. They're all together. And it's a very poignant scene, the way he's looking at this thing. And right as he's doing that, the doctor comes in and says,
just shakes his head.
The horse has to be put down. And he takes the gun to go shoot the horse and he can't bring himself to do it.
His hand's shaking.
He orders one of the other officers to do it. And at this point, this is when Lady Ashmore.
And wouldn't you know, this is when Lady Ashmore shows up.
She chooses to come in now. And then again, he's very vulnerable. He tells her, I can't even kill a crippled horse. And he introduces her to all the soldiers. He tells them to shake her hand.
Yep.
And then you hear the shot. And then he sort of collapses.
Breaks another glass.
He sits on the thing and his head's down. And I think
internally he collapsed.
He's clearly in pain. He breaks the glass in his hand. He's very good at breaking glasses.
Very.
Brenner throughout this whole film. And the other soldiers all just kind of
leave the room. Yeah. They're like, okay, we know not to
and
stay.
The whole time he's kind of not facing her, his back's to her. And I think maybe he thinks she's left too, because he sort of finally gets himself straightened up and she's still there and starts asking her what she wants. And, oh, you like seeing me like this, like seeing vulnerable. And then
I like how she flat out just tells him, oh, the others asked me to come.
She's not very nice to him.
Right?
Yeah, she's not very nice to him.
It's like he's in this incredibly vulnerable position.
Can't you be somewhat sympathetic to him?
Yeah.
He basically admits that he wants her, that meeting her has thrown him into confusion, and that's why he doesn't know what's right and what's wrong anymore. Asking why she's there, and then she admits that the others made her come. She can't even say, I wanted to come. And he sort of calls her a martyr. He doesn't want to believe that that's her reason for coming. He wants to believe she wants him. And he goes on this big speech telling her about all these times when he knows that she was lying, that because she felt something for him and she was hiding it and she keeps denying it. Never at any point does she admit to this, but he forces her to kiss him and she kisses him. And then there's this big dramatic music which goes into the church bells.
Again. Okay.
And then she asks him to let her go and he does.
Yeah.
And we are not going to say anything else.
Yeah. Oh, it's a very frustrating scene.
And the question I wonder is, does she really not like him? And is everything she's saying on the up and up? Or is she saying that she does really like him and she's just saying that to protect herself? Which is it? You're never really certain.
The movie doesn't give you an idea. I think
Deborah Carr doesn't give you an idea. You can't really ever tell.
Yeah, I think that is one of the frustrating things. But I think it is nice because you get to decide that. I personally think she does like him.
I do too.
She is attracted to him, but she's had this mission to get her lover, who is wounded, practically almost dying.
Whose fault it is of hers. Her fault.
Her fault that he's in the pain that he's in. She's desperate to get him out of there. And I think as much as she does want Major Suroff, I think she feels that she would get along with him, especially when he would reveal.
And she probably thinks, how could this possibly work?
Right.
How am I going to be involved with a Russian major?
Yeah, she can't admit feelings for him when she's got to do this.
Yeah, and plus the people that are persecuting her, supposed man, the exact people. It's very unclear, and the ending is very something.
Yeah.
It's a scene I don't think it's very expected. I think it's surprising.
I didn't expect it when I first watched it.
I think it's surprising. I think it's very symbolic.
Yes.
And I think you should see it for yourself.
Oh,
and find out. We should definitely not tell you.
Yeah, I don't want to tell you guys. As much as I would love to talk about everything. It's really beautiful. It's a really beautiful ending.
This is all around a beautiful movie. Yeah. And that brings us to our question. What would you rate this movie 1 to 5?
Oh, my gosh. 1 to 5. I absolutely want to give it 4, but that's me. I know that there's problems. The score definitely has some rockiness. I know that they had rockiness with the script. But despite that, there is a lot of good writing in there. I guess maybe issues with story, possibly with the script, I think was a little rocky. But yeah, I want to give this 4.
I'm going to give it a 4 too.
Okay,
so
thank
you don't
God.
Have to feel. No, I'm going to give it a 4. And I mean, that's pretty high for me because I really did not enjoy the score at all. Mm-hmm. I did think the acting was excellent. And I thought that was a high point of the film.
We talked about this before we recorded, but the acting is one of my favorite things about this. And it's not just Yul Brynner being incredibly amazing, Deborah Carr being amazing. I think everybody in this movie does a great job. Even Hungarians that are standing in the background, mm-hmm. not saying anything. Everybody did their job. There is, I believe, a Greek woman who's one of the passengers. She has a baby with her.
Yeah.
It is crying most of the time, which to me makes sense.
Yeah.
In that situation. Like we mentioned before, little Ronnie Howard.
Yeah, he's cute.
He does a fantastic job. There's not a single – I know you're bothered by that girl.
That girl. And I also don't particularly like the headquarters guy. I think he's a little bit ridiculous.
I'm not thrown off so much that it takes me out of the film.
Yeah.
To me, I can justify it and fit it in there
like
somewhere.
He's world weary, so that's why he can't speak in a Russian accent anymore. But that's okay.
But yeah, to me, I think everybody does a fantastic job. I think everybody does the job that they're supposed to do, and it works. And it's like, yes, we have all these passengers. Some of them, like, they don't even really have much to do.
Right.
But if they didn't do the jobs that they did, this movie would not be the same.
Yeah, it stands on the acting, this film. And the cinematography is excellent.
Yes, beautiful.
All the camera movement is very nice. There's a lot of nice camera movement. They do a great job of cutting to those close-ups when he's going to say something very significant. And it's a very effective way of adding another dimension to the film where you don't have to have your stupid, loud, dramatic, ridiculous music. You can use the camera to create the moment.
Or the simple sounds, like you said, when they were escaping
in
the boat.
Yeah.
I love
like
that
the sounds,
part, too.
The church bells, the horse
the church bells.
Yeah, those things, these little clues in the film.
It absolutely breaks my heart that not only that this film bombed, but that people really haven't remembered it, or they don't know it. Or if they do know it, they know it as the other Yul Brynner, Deborah Carr movie, and that's it.
Yes.
And it's a shame because I personally think their chemistry in this is better than The King and I. Not that The King and I is bad, but I prefer this one so much more.
Yeah.
It's just tremendous.
And I mean, it's always great when Yul Brynner can play a Russian, I think.
Yes.
I mean, when he
Isn't
can play
nice?
A Russian, I feel he's most at home, he's most comfortable, and he's certainly most fit for the part. It works really well on him, especially when he gets to speak his own native language, even though he could speak 11 languages, apparently. It's nice when he gets to speak actual Russian.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I think that's probably all the time we have for today. But I want to thank you again, Debbie, for being our guest.
Thank you. I'm always happy to talk about this movie with anybody.
And hopefully we can convince some folks to give this a try.
From what I saw, it used to be on YouTube. The whole thing used to be on YouTube, but it is not there anymore.
It's not a library
but
either.
But honestly, you can rent it off of Amazon. It's worth it. But to me, it's worth your money. Give it a shot.
I do believe occasionally they will play this on TCM.
Oh, yes, they do. They absolutely do. Usually if it's something to do with Deborah Carr or Yul Brynner, they usually show it. To me, I bought it off of Amazon. This movie's in my top 10.
Yeah.
Like in my top 10 favorite movies of all time.
It's really worth seeing.
It's just so wonderful. And I can't recommend this movie enough.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm so glad you love it, too. It's like,
I do
love
it. I do love it. And we both love Yul Brynner. That is one definite thing.
Absolutely.
So anyhow, thank you again for being the guest. And for Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy's Classic Film Review, this is Wendy saying goodbye. Thank you for listening to our podcast today. Please don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. And please leave us a comment or a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Intro and outro music composed by Heidi Engel. Artwork by Tyler Birch. Produced and edited by Wendy Wittick. Recorded at PCTV Studios, Pittsburgh, PA. See you next time.